Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments today. First, in seconds, we'll hear from law professor Gene Nickel about the war on both the poor and on academic freedom in North Carolina. And at the bottom of the hour, an editor and contributor to the anthology of the Best of Spread magazine talk about sex work and the challenges of publishing a mag by and for sex workers. My first guest is Gene Nickel, a professor of law at the University of North Carolina and director of the university's Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity, which is being closed down in order of the state government for publishing studies critical of what Nichols calls a war on poor people. North Carolina, which has for the last half century been one of the most progressive states in the South, is now in the grip of reaction, and Gene Nickel will tell us the story. Welcome, Gene Nickel. Boy, it seems like your state has been taken over by reactionary forces in the Capitol. Tell us what's the general political lay of the land looking like?
Well, I think it's not a big secret that North Carolina has undergone a pretty radical transformation in its state government in the last 2 or 3 years. We have large Republican majorities in both houses of the General Assembly and a Republican governor, and they've been embarked upon an effort to change the character and the nature of the Commonwealth here in North Carolina, and they've been very effective at it. It's involved a lot of legislation, but we have concentrated a great deal on what has been an unprecedented war on poor people down here. I think unlike anything that's happened in North Carolina's modern history, and more potent and pointed, I think, than is occurring in any other state. We, like some other states, I suppose, we rejected the Medicaid expansion, but what it's meant here is 500,000 people were knocked off the Medicaid rolls. A Harvard study last year indicates that we can expect that 1,000 North Carolinians a year will die as a result of that choice. And despite that, neither the governor nor any of the leaders in the General Assembly can explain with a straight face why they did it. I think they're in a competition to show they can be more harsh and cruel than any other state government. We launched the largest cut to an unemployment compensation program in American history since those programs began in the 30s. We eliminated the state's earned income tax credit, which meant that for, you know, working families making maybe $35,000 a year, they have a significant tax increase as necessary to do that to 930,000 North Carolinians in order to pay for tax cuts which go to the very wealthiest members of our state. State government rushed in to be the first to cut food stamps during the government shutdown. We're having significant poverty and hunger problems in North Carolina, so their response was to cut the state's allocation to food banks in half. This has been a war on poor people, which is, I think, it's not difficult to say it's unprecedented. So it's had a potent and crushing impact on a lot of low-income folks in North Carolina. The center where I work has worked hard to document it and describe it, and we've published a great deal about it. We have, as a result, I think in the last 2 years, I've been repeatedly threatened by leaders in the General Assembly. The threats sort of passed along through university officials that if I didn't stop writing about the General Assembly and the governor for the Raleigh News and Observer, where I've been writing a long time, that they would close the center, or they would get rid of me, or they would move the center to UNC Pembroke. They threatened that extensively, and then I think through this charade of a review process, they pulled it off.
The electorate of North Carolina is not uniformly conservative, right? It's a much more divided state than what you've been outlining would you would expect.
It is. I mean, in 2008, North Carolina voted for Obama. It was close in 2012. But I think in part, there was something of a national trend in 2010 as part of the pushback against President Obama's election. And that hit very profoundly in North Carolina, and so for the first time we had Republican majorities in both houses and in the governor's office. And since that time, a lot of the leadership in the legislature has been competing for ascendancy with the Tea Party crowd. And, you know, it's not what you want to happen to your state, to have the leader of the House and the leader of the Senate doing their best to try and outshine each other for the affections of the Tea Party. And we have a Republican governor who's sort of weak and hapless, probably not as directed as the leaders of the legislature, but he certainly is not going to stand in their way on any of these measures.
And how is this going down? Is it popular?
It is, as you might guess, intensely unpopular with a large segment of the state, but to be candid, it must be marginally popular with a lot of the state because we just had another election and the Republicans held on to both houses with very little loss. It has triggered, as you've likely know, a massive protest movement, the Moral Monday movement, which a lot of us have been intensely involved in. It may be the most, I think, vibrant political movement in the South or maybe in the country, but it has not yet been able to reverse this tide, which is doing massive harm to the state of North Carolina.
Since North Carolina is not a major media center, I think the Moral Monday thing may not have gotten the attention it's deserved. Could you talk a bit more about its history and what it's all about?
It's under the leadership of a charismatic president of the North Carolina NAACP named William Barber. It's been my honor to work with Reverend Barber a lot. It began as, it's a movement of long standing with roots across the progressive community, but it picked up speed dramatically when 2 years ago the legislature launched this war on poor people and people of color, a legislative agenda which is frankly at odds with the way most people see the world in North Carolina. So we started having large protests on each Monday of the legislative session. They began with a few thousand people, but grew to many thousands. I think the largest was at a protest downtown last year where we had 100,000 people, and we've got folks coming in from all over the country, and the Moral Monday movement is being expanded to other states. We are fortunate to have a remarkable leader here to galvanize it, but I think what it reflects is that for a large number of North Carolinians, what's been happening in the State House and in the governor's office is literally horrifying. It is a threat to the decency and the traditions of the state, and folks are working very hard to try and stop North Carolina from being converted to a commonwealth that they don't recognize and that loses its decency.
I presume this war on poor people you were describing is heavily racialized?
Yes, heavily racialized. That's tragic, but of course it begins with the notion that race and poverty have never been very distinct or separable in North Carolina like in the rest of the South. But we have, if you think about it, we have very large Republican majorities in both houses of the legislature. We have a cabinet and a governor who are all white. When those two parties in the leadership in the House and the Senate, when those two large caucuses go in to deliberate, they have no black members, even though North Carolina is 23% African-American. And then they have proceeded to pass bill, first of all, repealing the Racial Justice Act, which was a landmark law in North Carolina designed to try and provide remedies in the criminal justice system for race discrimination. That was quickly repealed. They said that we wouldn't accept Medicaid. They passed a monster voting law, which, like others, through voter IDs and various restrictions, makes it more difficult for people of color to vote, more difficult for students to vote. It's all quite pointed and intentional, hoping to disenfranchise those who don't vote the way the folks in the state house wish they would vote, and a little bit recognizing that the writing is on the wall. You know, in 10 years, 15 years, you won't be able to govern in North Carolina as a white people's party, just like I think it's, I don't know, that's how I've always read the Romney campaign. It's no longer possible in a national presidential election to win as just a white people's party. North Carolina, it still is possible, but it won't be for long. And so these folks are getting in, and while the getting's good, and they're working hard, of course, to skew the playing field, to limit access to the political process so that they can hang on longer.
Now, as I recall, they did a masterful job of gerrymandering the congressional districts so that a small electoral majority can turn into a large legislative one. Have they done the same thing at the state level?
Yes. Both our state legislative districts and the congressional districts are massively and expertly gerrymandered. They've both been challenged in the courts, and those lawsuits are not complete yet. But, you know, it means that the legislative districts are such that this is what I've told folks for a couple years. You would have to have a strong enough grassroots political movement whereby 60-65% of North Carolinians stood strong and said, we're not going to allow this state to be converted to South Carolina or Mississippi. That's not our tradition. That's not the way North Carolinians broadly see themselves. But you won't be able to do it with just a simple majority because the districts are so gerrymandered. And it's not going to be a reasonable answer to say, let's wait, you know, 8 years till the Republicans overplay their hand, because there will be so much damage done to this state in 8 years that we won't be able to recover for generations. We have a real Donnybrook here, a real fight over whether North Carolina is going to be a state that retains a sense of decency, or whether it's going to, in effect, continue this process of governing just for the wealthy, just for the white, just for the Christian, just for the straight, just for the male, or whether it's going to attempt to represent all members of this commonwealth.
I'm speaking with Gene Nickel, who is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina and director of its now former Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity. You mentioned a contrast with South Carolina. I mean, is South Carolina radically different in political terms from what North Carolina has been?
Yes. North Carolinians are quite proud of that. We have a much different political history than South Carolina does. But the folks leading the show now, I think, probably have much more kinship with South Carolina's traditions than North Carolina's. We've joked that, you know, one of the final bills in the legislative session is going to be to take up the border between North Carolina and South Carolina and announce now political soulmates. It's just one Carolina. You know, if you looked at the history of North Carolina, the history of the South, we have moved in a very different set of directions than South Carolina, much of the Deep South, and have been proud of that. It has been part of the reason that in the last 50 years, North Carolina moved socially and culturally and economically from being at the very bottom of the South. You know, people didn't used to say 50 years ago, thank God for Louisiana. They said, thank God for North Carolina, when they were looking at the bottom of the barrel. But that's not the way North Carolina is now. We've, through, I think, a half century of struggle and tough decisions to invest in our people and our politics. North Carolina's climbed at least sort of the top of the South, and we frequently compete very effectively with the rest of the country. The folks who are running government in North Carolina now don't understand that history. Most of them are not familiar with it, and they think the sole goal of government is to provide as extensive set of breaks to the very wealthiest among us as can be managed. That's not been a successful history in North Carolina, and so we've got to do a great deal to try and defend ourselves and to return to the sort of society that I do think most North Carolinians believe in.
What about your northern neighbor? Is anything going on similarly in Virginia?
Virginia has, in some ways, a similar sort of makeup. It is split politically, as you know. I think it's for a little different reasons. I lived in Virginia for a time, and northern Virginia is much, and you know, the sprawling D.C. suburbs, is probably much different than the rest of the state, and it's huge, and it has a great population accumulations. And that impact, coming from northern Virginia, has changed the political majorities and calculations in Virginia pretty effectively. The way I used to think about it is, in Virginia, northern Virginians are sort of beginning to outnumber traditional Virginia. North Carolina, it's not that it has a part of the state that's outnumbering its traditions. This is a state which is split, I think, historically, and has a pretty strong progressive trend, a pretty strong history of some significantly progressive leaders, at the same time that we've had you know, some of the most regressive leaders. A state that could have Terry Sanford in leadership and Jesse Helms at the same time is one which is split. Sometimes people will characterize North Carolina as a moderate state or a swing state. I guess that's right, but I think it's more a relatively evenly divided state with people feeling pretty strongly on both sides of the calculus.
Sounds a bit like Wisconsin, too.
Yes, and we're undergoing some of the same challenges that Wisconsin is.
Okay, now let's talk about your center, and there are two others around the state that they're trying to shut down. So give us that story.
I mean, for me, it's impossible to separate from, as I said, we've been trying to document and publish, actually with a great deal of success on the publication front, the impact of the war on poor people in North Carolina. We have done a great deal, I think, to make the effects of that of those efforts more broadly known. And as a result of that, we have not been viewed congenially by the General Assembly and the governor. And as I said, this is sort of old-fashioned stuff, old-school stuff. What they've been telling me is they will have various university officials tell me that, look, we're sick of this. We're sick of you writing in the newspaper in ways that are critical of the work of the General Assembly or the governor. So if you don't stop it, if you don't stop publishing in the News and Observer, you know, what they would tell me is it's okay to publish in the Harvard Law Review. Nobody reads that, but you got to stop publishing in the News and Observer. And if you don't, then we're going to close down the center. Well, I'm old and stubborn, and so I didn't agree to that. I also didn't agree to stop speaking at Moral Monday protests. And so they announced through their delegates on the Board of Governors that they were launching a study of 240 centers throughout the university system. Supposedly it was to capture $15 million in cost savings. They looked at those 240 centers and visited on the Poverty Center at Chapel Hill, along with one of my good colleagues at NC Central, the Student Engagement Center there, Jarvis Hall, who runs that, a good friend, and he is as well a strong leader in the North Carolina NAACP, and I think we're likely punished for that leadership. But so they went through this charade of a review. Ended up being very difficult because they discovered that the Poverty Center is totally privately funded and doesn't get any state money, and so that when they close us, we'll actually have to turn back dollars to foundations that support our poverty research. So it's not a very good cost-saving measure. But it was never meant to be. I think most folks in North Carolina, as soon as this review was announced, said, well, we don't know much, but we know they're going to close the Poverty Center. And so they did that. They'll require us to close by the end of the summer. They engaged in their review. It was a sham. They announced the decision. They purportedly came up with some reasons to close the Poverty Center, but I don't think a second person in North Carolina has believed it. The dean of the law school, who's named Jack Boger, who's been quite stand up in this, unlike the rest of the campus leadership, I think. I heard him give a speech a couple days ago, and he said, well, they've purportedly come up with some reasons to close the Poverty Center, but those are false. What the Board of Governors has done, actually, is they have closed down an academic center because they don't like what the director of the center publishes in the newspaper. They and their masters have threatened to do it for a couple of years, and now they've done it. It, you don't have to be a great master to recognize that it's a rank violation of the Constitution, of the First Amendment, of notions of academic freedom. It is a sort of core violation in that we have an arm of the government saying that we're not going to tolerate people criticizing the legislature and the governor in this state. And if you do, we're going to make sure that you're punished for it. Now, the good news from our point of view is when this began, a lot of foundations and individuals stepped forward and indicated to us that we're not going to allow the sort of forces on this front to prevail. We're not going to allow poverty research and study to be banished from the University of North Carolina. So they have indicated that they will support in powerful ways the continued operation of the center. So the center will be closed, but we've announced this. We're creating what's called a North Carolina Poverty Research Fund in the School of Law. Foundations have quickly indicated that they will support it heavily. So the end result will be that we'll be able to do the same work of the center through the auspices of this fund. We'll have more resources and more flexibility. And I think that's a real tribute to North Carolinians. They're not easily cowered by these kind of petty tyrants who are anxious to become bigger tyrants. So the Poverty Center's work is going to go forward and even be expanded. And I'm a tenured law professor. I mean, they would like to fire me, but they can't fire me. And I'm going to obviously keep writing and speaking and organizing. But that doesn't change what is occurring in North Carolina. That doesn't change the fact that we've got the Board of Governors, an agency of the state, in effect censoring expression of a faculty member because the governor and the leaders of the General Assembly don't like what a faculty member is saying. And then the Board of Governors has sort of compounded it by lying about what they're doing. There's a leader in the North Carolina Senate named Bob Rucho. A couple of days ago, he said, well, I think it's, and under our system, the Board of Governors sort of owe their membership, their selection to the leaders of the legislature. And Rucho said, it's a great thing that we've closed down the Poverty Center because Nickel is writing about poverty and he suggests solutions that people in the legislature don't agree with. I sort of warmed to Rucho. He may be a totalitarian, but at least he's not lying about it. Whereas the Board of Governors has just sort of mumbled about what they're doing and acted like somebody's pulling their strings in a way that's demeaning to the history of the University of North Carolina. These folks don't believe in a sense of public mission for the university. They think it ought only to serve the interest and the sons and daughters of wealthy North Carolinians, because that's the way they see the world. But that's not what our history has been, and it's a great betrayal of the meaning of the University of North Carolina.
That was Gene Nickel, a professor of law at UNC and director of the Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity, which is being closed down in order of the reactionaries in state government. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was the 15th of Beethoven's 33 variations on a waltz by Diabelli, performed by Alfred Brendel. Next up are contributors to an anthology, The Best of Spread magazine, just out from the Feminist Press. Spread, the S was rendered as a dollar sign, was founded in 2005, who, in the words of Eliana Kaiser, were tired of the way sex workers are sensationalized in the media and weren't given an opportunity to speak for themselves. For reasons of length, I had to cut Eliana's history of the founding of the magazine, so the beginning is a little abrupt. Here are Eliana Kaiser, one of the magazine and the anthology's editors, and Brendan Michael Connor, one of the contributors, and living proof that not all sex workers are women. And I learned just this afternoon reading the book that the word sex work was coined by Carol Lee in 1978.
Yeah, that's right.
I always think, I had a friend many years ago who heard the term culture workers, and he said, "What is this? We got into culture so we didn't have to work." Every time I hear sex worker, I think of that. The term itself is supposed to do some work, right? Uniting people who are not necessarily considered similar.
Yeah, I mean, the term sex work is a funny thing, because as soon as we stopped publishing the magazine, the sex worker rights movement started to go through this process of recognizing that it may not be the best term. But you know, maybe leave that for the end of the story of the term sex work. I mean, back in 1978, when Carol Lee came up with the idea, I mean, not to pretend that I know exactly what she was thinking, but I think it's pretty evident that it was a political organizing term. This was a sort of gathering together of the ranks of people that had this shared experience, that had shared stigma, even if the experience was very diverse. You know, there is this sort of stigma that, you know, attaches itself to anyone who exchanges any kind of erotic labor for, you know, some form of something, some kind of monetary remuneration, drugs, housing for the night, whatever they're getting in return for it. And so...
And many different kinds of labor you're talking about.
And many different kinds of labor. It could be phone sex labor, it could be fetish work, it could be vanilla prostitution, it could be stripping, it could be anything. I mean, this is a big, wide world. And so this was a way of creating sort of a linguistic organizing tool. So we want to have a word that describes this really, really big swath of people that helps them feel some kind of, you know, commonality, so that they see themselves as being linked. And the idea is sort of force a community to be created by having a word that, you know, describes everyone in it. And so it became this way that people started to identify that there was, you know, some kind of shared goals and experiences. And it served a really important purpose. I mean, I think we say in the book that, you know, this is what some feminists have long called consciousness raising, you know, and it had that impact for a lot of people. So when Spread started publishing, it was definitely a word that we embraced. And strangely enough, I feel like when I turn on the 6 o'clock news these days, that the mainstream media has started to use it as well. Although they seem to always mean prostitute when they say it.
And Brendan, how and when did you get involved in the project?
I don't think I came on until 2007, but I was aware of Spread even before then. Just to sort of elaborate on Spread's place in history, it didn't come forth, it didn't spring forth fully formed. I mean, there were so many sex worker made media strategies, whether published or otherwise, ranging from Dan Zine, photocopied and distributed on the streets and in strip clubs in Portland, to Pony Express, or simply bad date sheets that were written down on yellow notebook spiral paper and passed from worker to worker as they changed their shifts on the street. So sex worker publishing and media making existed long before Spread and exists after it. What was, I think, particularly unique about Spread was its appropriation of a sort of independent publishing framework and an attempt to bring together so many people from different strains of occupation. So it's not merely people on a stroll, not merely people in phone sex work or working as exotic dancers or erotic in other kinds of erotic labor, but creating an umbrella which is as expansive as the word sex work, I think, ideally would be. And one thing that attracted me when I first came on in 2007 as a 20-year-old hustler in New York City was that, at least in the pages of the magazine, it felt to me like the word sex work wasn't necessarily overused or assumed. I think the language in the magazine was, this is a magazine by and for people in the sex industry, which targets this kind of mode of labor or exchange of sex in exchange for resources that doesn't assume an identity of the people involved in it. So for many years of my life, I traded sex for 10 years total, and there were times when I felt like I was in a career, and there were times when it was easily on the spectrum of doing whatever I had to do, whether it was selling drugs or sleeping with someone who was older or engaging in double shifts at three manual labor jobs at the same time and on the weekends sleeping with my boss to get a better wage. It felt like there was a place for me in the magazine when I saw that it didn't assume where I had come from, but it knew where I was working, and its interest was how I would identify and how other folks who I would include in my communities would identify their needs were and what kind of remedies were demanded for our labor.
And so who was your intended or actually eventual outcome audience? Sex workers themselves, the general public, some combination of that?
The idea of trying to figure out who our audience was really an afterthought, unfortunately. And this really comes from not having a publishing background. I mean, the idea was a platform for sex workers to speak. And then once we became this real publication, suddenly we had all these things we had to deal with, whether that was distribution contracts or advertisers, and definitely that kind of basic, who is our audience? How do we make sure that we're reaching our intended audience? Those kinds of questions. And so it's never a good idea to have the sort of general public goal for any kind of communication strategy, at least of all magazine. We really wanted it to reach sex workers broadly. But of course, we were also interested in influencing public discourse around sex work. And so that meant trying to do a lot of things for a lot of different people. When we did our reader survey, our first reader survey, we discovered that the majority of the people who were reading the magazine were not who we wanted to be the majority of people reading the magazine. They were folks who had college degrees or higher, in majority. They were mostly white. There were not nearly enough people in the diverse aspects of the sex industry. There was a lot of strippers. There was a lot of people doing domination work. There was, I'm trying to remember if this correctly, there's a lot of people doing escorting. But there weren't a lot of street-based sex workers. And I remember being very stunned at how few people in the porn industry read the magazine. And that, I don't think we ever really got a big hold in the porn workers' audience. From that point forward, we had to sort of figure out what we were going to do to shift that and to really make sure that we were reaching a broader, you know, cross-section of the sex worker community, and also to be hitting, in terms of the general public, to keep the magazine interesting enough that those people who were reading it still wanted to, if we could possibly hold on to them as an audience. Because, you know, we weren't against having this academic interest. We weren't against having, you know, this general public interest, but we needed that not to be all we were.
And from the beginning, you had to deal with a certain philosophical editorial question of whether to take positions on things. You're not going to be a line organization like a disciplined party. For example, you know, there's a temptation to make everything look really good. because you're people who suffer from a stigma, and so you want to say, oh no, you know, things are really good, so you don't want to have, but you also don't want to be Pollyannish about it all and want to tell the truth. People have different experiences. So how did you deal with that?
I don't think there were ever people that were actively trying to tell an untrue story in that first year or so that we were publishing. I think that what happened is that there was a self-selecting group of people who, you know, wanted to write for the magazine. And that was generally people, generally, not exclusively, but generally people who had more positive things to say or whose critique extended to the outside world and not to the industry itself. That was mostly a matter, as I say, of self-selection. We had to really work hard to make it clear to people that there was room in the pages for dissent, for people that had some other experience they wanted to talk about, a different perspective, who didn't have, you know, overwhelmingly, you know, positive things to say or stories of empowerment. And I think you also have to understand that at the time, and to some extent this is still going on, you know, there was this kind of, you know, we've always been in sort of the crosshairs of different feminists fighting, you know, their sex battles, you know. There was a tendency then to look at this fight about choice versus coercion as sort of your two extremes and want to lean towards the side of choice, because the people who were suggesting that sex work is always coercive were doing so in a way that divorced sex workers from their own humanity and their own autonomy. And so it was, I think, quite understandable that sex workers were feeling defensive about that and were leaning towards telling stories that really highlighted the choices they made and not so much things that were done to them.
Oh, but the whole idea of choice is very problematic. We don't.
Yeah, but I mean,
we're very constrained in the choices we can make.
But all choices are constrained by
something. Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially in post-industrial capitalism, where low wage or marginalized labor, or even labor in a formal economy, is shot through with sexual discrimination and occupational barriers, even to entry, or high entry requirements in terms of documenting your citizenship status. And I think that when SPREAD sort of embraced that reality in which individual people could describe their own struggles inside the industry and through the prism of working in the industry, society's perception of them was pretty early on in the magazine. And the real challenge was reaching people to contribute to the magazine who had such high barriers to existence whatsoever, let alone to participate for free in an all-volunteer magazine. So that was reflected on the staff level and in the actual writing that came to be published in SPREAD. And the editors and the collective made a concerted and intentional choice to reach out and ratchet up outreach to folks who didn't have other ways to purchase SPREAD, whether it was through an online distributor or to go to a feminist bookstore in their urban metropolis that they were living in, and to really focus more on places where sex workers could get it en masse for free and distribute it, either by word of mouth, copying it on copy machines and printers for free. And that really reflects, I think, the beginning of the pull that eventually brought SPREAD to its end, which is being juxtaposed between the need to sustain a magazine that's all volunteer and requires actual costs that need to be covered, and then diverting those resources to actually devote, eventually it was 40%, I think, at our height of the print run, completely for free to needle exchanges, drop-in centers, homeless shelters, strip clubs, dungeons, brothels, on the streets, mobile outreach vans. We spanned, it wasn't just limited to the United States or Canada, or even the English-speaking world. I think, because when I came on in 2007, I began as an outreach assistant and then outreach director, and we had a whole sprawling chart and document that tracked our distribution, and it involved at least, I would say, 10 overseas territories or nations, and we really ran the gamut in where we actually contributed the magazines for free. We'd ship entire boxes flat rate at no cost to the recipients, and receive incredible submissions and response when we included with those outreach magazines and a way to submit by paper and postage actual submissions to the magazine. To this day, I hear from people, you know, what is it, 6 or 8 or 10 years later, who, when I encounter them and they worked at, you know, let's say a violence against women crisis center in Portland, Oregon, or I'm trying to think of another, a needle exchange in Durham, North Carolina, or
I met a girl from an HIV outreach place in Calgary, Alberta.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who are like, oh, I remember.
I'm speaking with Eliana Kaiser, who is one of the editors of Spread, the best magazine that illuminated the sex industry and started the media revolution, and to Brendan Michael Connor, who is one of the contributors. So how long did you go for?
How long did we publish
yeah.
for? 2005 until 2011. And it was really just 5 years of publication, but it spanned sort of that extra year because there were some delays in the last issue coming out, or the last two issues.
And I noticed you, one of your early retreats, the topic was how can we avoid burnout and hating each other?
Yes.
Did you succeed or fail?
A little both.
Does anyone succeed?
Yeah. I mean, it was an all volunteer effort, right? And so we're doing something which was for most of us a second full-time job. Right. I mean, we all had our other jobs, whether they were sex work jobs or other jobs.
Or sex work and other jobs.
You know, I mean, like whatever everyone's dealing with. And on top of whatever responsibilities they have to partners, kids, not so many kids at that point in time, but eventually pets, grandparents, whatever. We're asking them to, you know, pull 30, 40 hours a week for Spread. I mean, that's not sort of an unrealistic number. I mean, during production, it got worse than that. And so, yeah, you know, we had some real issues to deal with. I mean, we went from a business model of let's try and make sure that people are paid and let's go towards that to let's try and make sure that we can give as much away for free as possible. And that was not happy for a lot of people. I mean, that was a real disappointment for people that had put years and years of labor and sweat into this thing, hoping to one day be able to, you know, in some ways supplement their living on it. And for some people that meant thinking that they could maybe cut down on their sex work too. So, I mean, those were real concerns for people. Also, we had a lot of, you know, disagreements as any sort of activist social movement-y thing does. I mean, thank God we came up with that editorial position of not taking positions. That really probably did save us from killing each other. And that was a fight. But I mean, it was a fight that we all inevitably came to the same conclusion on. I don't think there was anyone who walked away from that staff retreat where we decided that we would have no positions not feeling good about that.
But you hadn't gotten into it thinking that.
No. I mean, we all had very strong opinions on different political issues. And, you know, in our group, there were people that identified as anarchists. There's people who identified as socialists. And there's people that didn't really care about economic politics, but saw themselves as sex work activists, or, you know, from feminism was the major identity or whatever.
And don't want to be harassed by cops or beat up by clients.
Sure. You know, and there's people that thought that, like me, that, you know, some kind of regulatory framework for prostitution was a good idea. And other people who think that's just crazy and oppressive and that the only solution is no laws, decriminalization, a sort of more libertarian take. And so,
yeah,
you know, I mean,
this is a controversy in the field, yeah. Right? What is the difference between decriminalization and legalization? Why do people support one?
I can only tell you what I think the difference between those two things are. Because, I mean, there's no sort of document I can point you to. I mean, this is sort of, anytime someone talks about these issues, I sort of get a different sense of the way they're defining it, if that makes sense. But the way that I see that topic debated in the community, it seems like there's some people who think that because of the nature of, I'm going to try and give their best argument, because of the nature of capitalism and the nature of the police state and the nature of patriarchy and racism, that any kind of government framework for prostitution will be inherently oppressive, and therefore the best solution is to decriminalize it and not have any laws associated with it. Government hands off our bodies.
We wouldn't like that with the food supply, though.
Yeah, I mean, so as someone who identifies as a socialist, I immediately want to poke a million holes in this. And I hope I did that side of the argument justice, because it's not my side of the argument, so I'm probably not the best person to be representing it. But yeah, I mean, I'm someone who's worked in government. I identify as a socialist myself. And to me, you know, the best thing that we could do is try to have as much reform of laws as we can from a labor interest in terms of people who are doing the work of different parts of the sex industry, advocating for what laws and rules and workplace standards make the most sense for their sector of the industry. That's what I want to see.
Brendan, you're a lawyer, so do you have a perspective on this?
Of course he does.
Well, I became a lawyer to weaponize the law and hold back the state long enough that communities could organize and regulate themselves in a more accountable fashion. So I might take I might be diametrically opposed to a socialist and legalistic framework, but I would just point out, the analog
is...
You're
not a libertarian.
No, absolutely not. The analog is drug policy reform, right? And the idea that the difference between decriminalization and legalization or regulation is the government or some kind of licensing agency creates barriers to licensure and entry and the quality of the product, its distribution. And the way that it's actually applied in sex work, speaking for the other side of the argument, is often as a mechanism of discrimination and control, which separates the deserving from the undeserving, which regulates a market and restricts it to the extent that it can be profitable for a higher echelon that can actually make it through those barriers, who has documentation and citizenship, who can receive a higher wage as a result of their skin color or their gender identity or presentation. And so I think, to either say that legalization, pure legalization or pure decriminalization was ever something that a sex worker activist had spread or even espoused in its pages is, I think, false, because the fact is, as reflected in the pages, neither of these views that we've just expressed, if you actually read the magazine, that it doesn't embody any of those one views. It points out the intricacies and the complexities of people's lived experience, whether it means being priced out of a strip club because a woman has brown skin, or being unable to enter into a in-call level escort agency because you don't have papers and aren't able to sign certain contracts or have a social security number and report your taxes. So I think...
But there are some, moments in the anthology and in the pages of Spread where people did deal with political issues. They just did it as individuals who were sex workers who were speaking for themselves, which is the whole point. I mean, we didn't tailor it editorially. We weren't saying... We, would like you to change this in some way. We weren't trying to curate a particular point of view. We decided at that very early stage that what was most important was that anyone, regardless of their point of view, felt comfortable submitting to the magazine and speaking their mind. So there were, for instance, moments where we did talk about these kinds of issues. We actually have in the book Aaron Siegel's American Brothel photo essay, which talks about some of the sort of civil liberties issues related to the regulatory scheme in some counties in Nevada, where there are some real problems with the way there are some really significant problems with the way the brothel system works in Nevada in terms of people's basic civil liberties. I'm assuming the laws are much the same today as they were when Aaron wrote that essay, but women can't, for instance, leave the brothel to go shop at the local drugstore
without armed security present.
Yeah, they're not allowed to walk around their town. How the ACLU isn't like all there right now, I don't understand. But these are real examples of people talking about these kinds of issues. The thing that I would sort of leave on though with the decriminalization and legalization debate in prostitution is just that this wasn't the most important part of the magazine. These kinds of divisive political issues, we were far more concerned with this expression of personal experience. And that wasn't because we were memoir happy, but it was because when it came down to it, people that were hungry to write for the magazine were hungry for an opportunity to tell their story, first and foremost. That's something that people had been denied to such a great extent that to have these sort of higher level political debates was something we really had to coax out of people a lot of the time. So we had this column called Positions, for instance, where we would pose these kinds of controversial questions and find someone to take, some side of it or another, not necessarily directly opposing sides, but, different perspectives on it. It was often a struggle to find someone who, really felt strongly on one side or another of a political issue. We had to work hard at that sometimes. But that was because we wanted to inject the magazine with, some policy debate. But really, what were most people wanting to do? They wanted to talk about their lives.
We're just about out of time, but just give us an idea of what's in the book.
Okay. We divided the book into chapters that talk to some of the themes that we explored throughout the years of publication. There's labor and workplace, violence and resistance, and a chapter called Media? Is it called Media? Let's flip.
Yes, it is called Media.
Excellent.
Thank you.
And it's a best of collection. I mean, there's lots of things that didn't make it into the anthology, of course, but we tried to give people a sampling of, you know, the diversity of points of view, parts of the industry, and, you know, the talent of different writers that contributed.
And I think one thing I'm really happy about, the editors who coordinated this anthology, thank you, by the way, is that the level of thematic detail is really incredible. If you purchase this anthology and have the pleasure of reading through it, you'll see that there is everything from the positions column that was just mentioned, between whether or not it's ever okay to work for a pimp, or whether sex work is a sacred practice or just a job, to the American brothel photo essay, or a description of the use of sex offender registration in Louisiana, or an interview about gentrification in low-income and people of color communities in Washington, D.C., and its effects on the regulation of strip clubs among men of color. So you've really got, I think,
and there's light
incredible tableau.
Too. There are light moments.
I mean, I'm a darker...
Yes.
The penguins.
We had the penguins, yes. And we'll just leave that to everyone's imagination.
Those are Eliana Kaiser and Brendan Michael Connor. Eliana was one of the editors and Brendan a contributor to Spread magazine. An anthology of the best of the magazine, Spread, the best of the magazine that illuminated the sex industry and started a media revolution, is just out from the Feminist Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Stock Exchange Woman by Miss Kitten. Till next week, bye.
The wheel of high heels to speed off like a